So, imagine for a second that you want to buy this massive piece of property, like a beautiful, sprawling commercial building, right? And it's worth $100,000.
Okay, 100 grand.
Yeah, 100 grand. You walk into the bank, and the lender looks at you and says, hey, just give us a $5,000 security deposit.
Just 5 grand.
Just 5 grand. And they say, we aren't going to charge you a single cent of interest on the other 95,000. In fact, you don't even owe us the 95,000. Just leave the 5 grand here and you control the entire property.
Right, which sounds like a completely illegal scam.
Yeah, it sounds totally insane, or at
Right.
least like a phenomenal way for a bank to just, go completely
Bankrupt,
bankrupt.
yeah.
But in the world of futures contracts, that exact scenario isn't a scam. It's literally just Tuesday. Welcome to the deep dive.
It's the whole business model.
Exactly. Now, before we jump into the mechanics of how that is even legally possible, a quick note. This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 3 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. It's incredibly helpful for getting your reps in before test day. So check it out at certfuel.com. All right, let's just get right into it.
And CertFuel is a fantastic resource, and you're really going to need it because today we are conquering an absolute monster of a topic, which is speculative theory.
It's a beast.
It really is. Like, if you're listening to this to prepare for your Series 3 exam, you need to understand the sheer gravity of what we're covering today. Part one of the exam spans roughly 71% of the test across chapters 1 through 7 combined.
Wait, 71%.
71%, yeah.
That is a massive chunk of your score resting on just these core concepts. Like, listener, you absolutely cannot just flashcard your way through this.
No, rote memorization will completely fail you.
Right. The second the exam writers tweak the wording of a question,
Yeah.
you're toast. You have to understand the actual, like, underlying plumbing of the market.
Precisely. And the National Futures Association, they don't publish the exact per unit weights, but the concepts we're decoding today, they form the conceptual backbone of the entire industry.
Right.
We're going to look at why traders who have absolutely zero interest in ever owning, say, a physical barrel of crude oil,
Or a bushel of corn.
right, or corn, why they pour billions of dollars into the futures markets, what exactly are they doing, and what do they get in return?
So to figure that out, we're going to master what I like to call the big four forces of the futures market, which are risk, leverage, volatility, and market liquidity.
The big four.
The big four. And listener, as we tear these concepts apart today, I really want you to anchor everything to one core theme, like just one single word, which is symmetry.
Ooh, symmetry. That's the perfect framework for this.
Yeah.
Because in the financial markets and, especially in futures, the environment is brutally impartial. There are no free lunches.
No.
Whatever mechanism provides you with the leverage to make an absolute fortune is the exact same mechanism that can and will wipe out your entire account just as fast. The market doesn't care about your feelings, It only cares about the math.
Yeah, the math is ruthless. So if we are starting with the math, let's look at the foundational equation of the market here. Before we look at how a speculator actually makes money, I have to ask kind of a structural question.
Okay, shoot.
Why does the market even let them in the door? Like, if I'm a commercial farmer, why do I care if a bunch of algorithmic traders in Chicago or New York are just staring at screens betting on my crops?
Yeah.
Doesn't that just distort the reality of my business?
It's a great question. And to understand the function of the speculator, you have to completely understand the person standing on the exact opposite side of their trade. You have to understand the hedger.
Right. Okay, let's bring in some characters to anchor this, listener, because we're going to use these folks throughout the entire deep dive. So visualize them clearly. First up, we have Farmer Frank.
Classic Farmer Frank.
Frank is our classic hedger. He operates this massive commercial wheat farm. He has, I mean, millions of dollars tied up in tractors, diesel fuel, fertilizer, labor, you name it. He has a very real, very physical exposure to the wheat market.
And right now, Frank is sweating bullets.
Oh, he is losing sleep. Let's map out his timeline, right? He plants thousands of acres of wheat in the spring, but he won't be able to run his combine harvesters, pull that wheat out of the dirt, and actually sell it until the late fall.
Right, months away.
Months and months of uncertainty. He knows exactly what it cost him to plant the crop. So let's say his break-even cost is $6 a bushel. If global wheat prices plummet to like $4 a bushel by harvest time,
He's ruined.
yeah, Frank doesn't just lose a little money. He misses his equipment payments. The bank forecloses on his land, it's over.
And this is what the exam officially defines as price risk. It is the existential threat that the price of a physical commodity will move aggressively against a commercial business's interests, you know, before they can bring their product to the cash market.
Right.
Frank is desperate to lock in a survival price today, even if it means giving up some potential extra profit later.
He just wants to survive.
Yeah.
So Frank needs to offload this massive, terrifying burden of price risk. And enter our second character, Speculator Sally.
Speculator Sally. She represents institutional capital.
Big money.
Big money. She might run a proprietary trading desk at a massive hedge fund. She operates out of a glass high-rise, uses predictive algorithms, and has absolutely zero commercial interest in physical wheat.
None at all. She thinks dirt is gross, probably.
Exactly. She doesn't own a silo, she doesn't bake bread, and if a literal dump truck full of raw grain ever showed up at her office building,
it would be a complete disaster.
Total disaster for her. But she has millions of dollars in capital, and she is constantly hunting for a return on that capital. She wants to generate a profit simply by predicting which direction prices are going to move.
So this dynamic sets up the foundational handoff of the futures market, right? This is the entire reason the exchange was built. The hedger farmer, Frank, wants to transfer his price risk away so he can just sleep at night.
Yep.
And the speculator Sally, voluntarily agrees to accept that exact same price risk, but only because the market offers her the opportunity to make a profit if she manages it correctly.
It's basically a game of hot potato.
Oh, but with a flamethrower.
Yeah, exactly. Frank is holding this glowing, burning hot potato of price risk. It's going to burn his farm to the ground if he keeps holding it. So he is desperately looking for someone to throw it to.
Right.
And Sally is standing across the trading floor wearing fireproof gloves, and she willingly catches it. Why? Because the rules of the exchange say, hey, if you can juggle this burning potato for 3 months without dropping it, there is a massive cash prize.
I love that. And, you know, the hot potato analogy works beautifully for one specific reason. And listener, this is a critical concept for the Series 3. The risk itself does not disappear.
No, never.
Let me stop and make sure I'm translating this correctly. You're saying that when Frank executes a hedge, he hasn't eliminated the danger of global wheat prices crashing. Like, he hasn't changed the weather. He hasn't changed global supply and demand.
Exactly. The inherent volatility of the world remains unchanged. The potato is still burning hot. When Frank hedges, the risk simply changes owners.
It just shifts.
Right. Speculator Sally absorbs it. She brings her capital and her willingness to bear risk into the marketplace. If Sally and her firm weren't there standing in the pit ready to catch the potato, Frank would have absolutely no one to hand it to.
Wow.
Commercial hedging is fundamentally impossible without speculators willing to assume the other side of the risk.
Okay, listener, I am stopping the deep dive right here. We need to drill down into exactly how Sally catches this risk, because the math of how she can lose her money is heavily tested. I'm going to ask you a direct question, and I want you to answer it in your head before we explain it. Ready?
Pay attention to this one.
Let's say Sally analyzes her weather models and decides there's going to be a massive shortage of wheat. So she thinks the price is going to skyrocket. So she buys a futures contract. In market terminology, buying makes her long. Sally has established a long position. Here's the question. What specific market movement causes Sally to lose money? And what is her absolute maximum possible loss? I'll give you a beat.
Think about it. She bought it.
Okay, let's break it down.
All right, so if Sally is long, she bought the contract hoping the price will increase. Therefore, she loses money if the price falls. Every single penny the price of wheat drops below her purchase price, cash bleeds out of her account.
But how deep can that bleeding go? Like, what is the floor?
The exam terminology for the long position maximum loss is large, but bounded.
Bounded.
Bounded means there's a mathematical limit. There is a hard floor that the price cannot penetrate, and that floor is zero.
Okay. Let's take it to the extreme just to visualize it.
Okay.
Let's say tomorrow morning, some tech company releases a nutritional paste that perfectly replicates bread, costs 1 cent to make, and, I don't know, cures the common cold.
A miracle paste.
Right. The global demand for physical wheat evaporates instantly. Yeah. Nobody wants it. The price of wheat plummets to absolute zero.
Right. So in that apocalyptic scenario, Speculator Sally loses the entire notional value of her contract. If she bought a wheat contract valued at $50,000 and the price drops to zero, she loses exactly $50,000.
Ouch.
It is a catastrophic loss for her trade, but the key word is stops. The bleeding stops. The price of wheat cannot go to negative $10 a bushel. A commodity cannot have a negative inherent physical value in standard market mechanics.
Right, it hits the floor.
Exactly. The price hits the floor of zero. Her risk is undeniably large, but it is bounded.
Okay, that makes logical sense. But let's flip the board entirely. What if Sally's algorithms tell her there is going to be a massive oversupply of wheat? Like the weather is perfect globally. She wants to bet against the price of wheat. So she sells a futures contract to open her position. She is now taking a short position. Listener, quick check. If she is short, she makes money when the price goes down. So she loses money when the price goes up.
Correct.
But wait, if I put myself in the shoes of a test taker who's just relying on common sense, surely there is a limit to how high the price of a commodity can go, right? Like a single loaf of bread isn't going to cost $1 million, so a short position must have a limit too.
And that assumption right there is exactly why human intuition is so dangerous in financial markets, and it is why traders constantly blow up their accounts.
Oh, wow.
Because no, there is no ceiling on a price. In the theoretical architecture of the market, a price can rise to infinity.
Hold on. Infinity. Literally.
Yes. Picture a vertical number line. For the long position, you start at the current price, say $10, and you look down. You can clearly see the zero. You can see the concrete floor.
Yeah.
But for the short position, you start at $10 and you look up. And that line just shoots up past the clouds, past the atmosphere, and into deep space. There is no mathematical ceiling overhead.
So you are saying the short position maximum loss is theoretically unlimited.
Theoretically unlimited, yes. Let's introduce our third character to really illustrate the just financial violence of this concept. Listener, meet Reckless Ricky.
Oh, Reckless Ricky. This is the guy who constantly falls for every single psychological trap the market and the Series 3 exam have to offer. Ricky trades on gut feeling instead of math.
Exactly. So Ricky decides to short wheat futures. He sells contracts at $10 a bushel, absolutely convinced a bumper crop is coming and prices will drop to $5. He is already dreaming of his profits.
Buying a boat, yeah. But Ricky doesn't check the long-term weather report. And a historic once-in-a-millennium global drought hits. Every major wheat-producing region on Earth just turns to dust.
Panic buying ensues immediately. Global food conglomerates are terrified they won't be able to stock grocery shelves. So the price of wheat surges to $20. Ricky is deep in the red. Then it goes to $50.
Oh, man.
Ricky's broker is blowing up his phone. It goes to $100, $200, $1,000 a bushel.
Wait, I have to pause. Why would anyone actually pay $1,000 for a bushel of wheat?
Because the desperate bread companies have no choice. They have commercial obligations to fulfill. They will bid the price up to whatever level is required to secure the tiny amount of physical wheat left in the world. And here's Ricky's nightmare. Because he sold a contract to open his position, he has a legal obligation to eventually buy a contract back to close it. He has to buy it back. And he has to buy it back at whatever the current astronomical, panic-driven market price is. If the price is $1,000, he has to pay $1,000 to exit his $10 trade. His losses just keep compounding endlessly into the stratosphere.
There's no cap.
There is absolutely no mathematical cap on how much money Ricky can lose when he is short.
All right. Exam trap alert. Listener, consider this a blaring siren. I am pulling the fire alarm right now. This specific dynamic is one of the exam writer's absolute favorite traps.
Yeah.
They will intentionally try to twist your brain on the direction of risk.
Oh, it is guaranteed to show up in multiple variations. It always does.
If you are staring at a multiple choice question and an option says something like, the purchaser of a futures contract faces theoretically unlimited risk, cross it out immediately. It's complete garbage.
Right, because the purchaser is long and a price can only fall to zero. Bounded risk.
Exactly. And if an option says the seller of a futures contract has risk limited to the contract value, cross it out. It's a lie.
Because the seller is short and a price can rise without any upper limit. Unlimited risk.
Reckless Ricky fails his practice exams because he reads the questions too fast. He sees the word risk, gets his longs and shorts backwards, and just clicks the wrong button. Don't be Ricky. Long is bounded at zero. Short is unlimited to the upside. Drill that into your brain.
And as we move forward, remember the fundamental difference between Ricky, Sally, and Farmer Frank. Neither Ricky nor Sally have any intention of making or taking delivery of actual physical wheat.
Right. They don't want the wheat.
They don't own silos or rail cars. They fully intend to offset their positions, you know, to buy or sell them back to close the trade long before the contract expires and delivery is actually required. Their exposure is purely to the financial price movement. Farmer Frank's exposure is physical.
Okay, that paints a very clear picture of the what and the why regarding speculators. Sally assumes Frank's risk because she wants a shot at the profit. But that naturally leads us to a massive structural question. Why does Sally choose to do this in the futures market? Like, if she has millions of dollars and wants to bet on price movements, why doesn't she just go buy stocks?
Yeah.
Or real estate? Or, you know, physical gold bars?
Yeah.
What is the specific secret sauce of the futures exchange that lures her capital in?
The secret sauce, the absolute engine of the entire speculative industry, is our second fundamental force, leverage.
Leverage, the financial superpower.
That is exactly what it is. Leverage in the futures market provides the ability to control a massive, enormous contract value, what the industry calls the notional value, while committing only a very small fraction of your own capital upfront.
Okay, let's dissect this, because I know the word margin gets thrown around constantly in finance, and it severely confuses people who are crossing over from the stock market.
Oh, constantly.
Yeah. In the futures world, this small chunk of capital you have to commit is properly called the performance bond. Sometimes the exam might refer to it as futures margin, but performance bond is the much more accurate term. So how does it actually function?
A performance bond is simply a good faith financial deposit. It is a guarantee that you post with your broker to prove to the clearinghouse, hey, I have enough liquid cash on hand to meet my daily obligations as the price of this massive contract fluctuates.
Got it.
It is not a down payment on a purchase.
Let's upgrade our metaphors here. Imagine you want to secure the rights to buy a massive fleet of commercial trucks worth $100,000. You want total control over the price of that fleet today. But the dealer doesn't make you write a check for $100,000. He says, just wire me $5,000 as earnest money. As long as you maintain that deposit to prove you're serious, you control the price locked in for the whole fleet.
That captures the essence perfectly. You are exerting control over a $100,000 asset using only $5,000 of actual cash deployment.
You get the keys to the kingdom for pennies on the dollar. That is the magnetic draw for speculator Sally. A tiny deposit buys her exposure to a massive financial footprint.
But this brings us squarely back to that core theme you established at the top of the deep dive. Symmetry.
Right, symmetry.
Leverage is not a magical discount provided by a generous market. It is a ruthless multiplier. And it cuts both ways with absolute mathematical indifference.
Listener, we are going to do some deep math role play here to prove how violent this symmetry can be. Let's put reckless Ricky into a simulated trading week just to watch his account drain. Let's say Ricky wants to trade a futures contract that has a total notional value of $100,000. The exchange requires an initial performance bond. Let's call it initial margin of just $5,000. Ricky deposits his $5,000 on Monday morning.
Which means Ricky is operating with 20-to-1 leverage. He has $5,000 doing the heavy lifting of $100,000.
Right. So let's say Tuesday rolls around and Ricky actually gets lucky. The overall value of the underlying commodity goes up by a measly 5%. Nothing crazy. 5% of $100,000 is $5,000. The contract is now worth $105,000. Ricky decides to close his position. He just realized a $5,000 profit.
Now, stop right there. I want you to ask the listener the critical question.
Listener, pause the audio if you have to. Calculate Ricky's return on his actual invested capital. What is his return on the deposit he made?
It's the key to everything.
Think about it. The overall market only moved 5%, but Ricky's return, it's 100%. He doubled his money, he put up $5,000, and he walked away with $5,000 in pure profit. He achieved 100% return on a tiny, almost boring 5% market move.
That right there is the intoxicating, addictive power of leverage, because your percentage return is measured exclusively against your small performance bond, not against the massive full contract value.
Right.
It makes small daily price ripples feel like massive tidal waves in your personal account.
Sally loves that.
Yeah.
Ricky loves that. I mean, when you are winning, leverage makes you feel like an absolute financial genius.
But here comes the dark side of the symmetry. Let's rewind the simulation back to Monday. Ricky posts his $5,000 initial margin for the $100,000 contract. But this time, on Tuesday, the market doesn't go up 5%. The market drops 10%.
Oh boy, down 10%.
A 10% drop on a $100,000 notional contract is a $10,000 loss.
Listener, map out the math in your head. Ricky only deposited $5,000 into his account.
Exactly. The $10,000 loss completely obliterates his entire $5,000 initial margin. It is instantly vaporized, and he is now in the hole for another $5,000.
Out of his own pocket.
He legally owes that money out of pocket to his broker to ensure the clearinghouse can pay the person on the winning side of his trade.
Wait, let me push back here, because this is where the mechanics get fuzzy for a lot of people. How does the market even know Ricky is losing money? Like, is there a guy with a ledger checking Ricky's trades at the end of the month?
No.
No. And this is a crucial mechanism for the Series 3. It happens every single day through a process called mark-to-market settlement.
Mark-to-market. Let's break that down.
At the end of every single trading session, the clearinghouse looks at the closing price of the commodity. They calculate exactly who won and who lost that day. And they literally transfer the cash from the loser's margin account directly into the winner's margin account.
Wow.
It is settled daily. The risk is managed in real time.
So Ricky doesn't get to just hold a losing position for 3 months and hope it bounces back without paying up?
Absolutely not. Which introduces the concept of maintenance margin. Let's say Ricky's initial margin to get into the trade was $5,000. The exchange might set the maintenance margin, the absolute bare minimum balance he must keep in the account to keep the trade open, at $4,000.
Okay, so if the market moves against him by just $1,001 on Tuesday afternoon, his account drops to $3,999. He has breached the maintenance level.
And that triggers the dreaded margin call.
The broker picks up the phone.
Ricky, you are under maintenance margin. You need to wire us funds immediately. And here is the trick that catches people on the exam. Ricky doesn't just deposit enough to get back up to the $4,000 maintenance level.
Right. The exam will try to trick you on this math.
If you breach maintenance margin, you must deposit enough funds to restore your account all the way back up to the original initial margin level of $5,000. In our scenario, his account is at roughly $3,000. He doesn't just need $1,000. He needs to wire $2,000 to get back to the $5,000 starting line.
And what if he doesn't have the cash?
The broker doesn't wait around. They will automatically liquidate his position, closing his trade at a loss to prevent his negative balance from infecting the rest of the clearinghouse.
Exam trap alert. Listener, listen to the sirens. The exam will give you a scenario exactly like Ricky's 10% drop, and one of the multiple choice answers will say something comforting like, the speculator's maximum losses are capped at the amount of their initial performance bond.
That is absolutely unequivocally false.
It is a total lie. Leverage means losses can, and frequently do, exceed your initial deposit. Your risk is not limited to what you put in the account. When they say leverage magnifies risk, they mean it acts like an excavator. It can dig a hole far deeper than your pockets can fill.
Which brings up a mandatory point of comparison, because students, especially our friend Reckless Ricky, constantly confuse futures margin with securities margin.
Oh, all the time.
They share the same word, but legally and structurally, they are completely different animals.
We need to do a strict side-by-side comparison right now. If you have ever traded stocks on margin on, say, Robinhood or Charles Schwab, you have to temporarily unlearn everything you know.
Yeah.
Because applying stock market logic to a futures exam will guarantee a feeling great.
Let's break it down systematically, point by point. First, what actually is it?
In futures, as we just established, the performance bond, or futures margin, is merely a good faith security deposit. You haven't purchased anything. It is collateral to guarantee your future performance on a contract.
But in the securities market, say you are buying shares of Apple stock on margin, that margin is a partial payment on a loan financed purchase. You are actually buying the physical shares of stock, and you are borrowing real cash from your broker to pay for the remaining balance.
That distinction is huge. So, second point of comparison, who is required to post it?
In futures, both the buyer the long and the seller the short must post a performance bond. Both sides have to prove to the clearinghouse they're good for the money if the daily mark-to-market settlement goes against them.
But in securities, only the buyer posts margin because they're the only one taking out a loan to buy the asset. The seller just sells their shares, collects the cash, and walks away entirely.
Exactly. Third, and perhaps most heavily tested on the Series 3, is there any borrowing or interest involved?
Okay, picture this. Reckless Ricky opens a futures account. He posts his $5,000 performance bond for his $100,000 contract. At the end of the month, he calls his futures broker and says, hey man, I'm just calling to make my monthly interest payment on that $95,000 you loan me for the week contract.
The broker would be utterly confused.
The broker would probably hang up. He'd say, it's a security deposit, Ricky, not a mortgage. In the futures market, there is no borrowing. You are not taking out a loan for the remaining $95,000 of the contract's notional value. Therefore, you owe absolutely zero interest.
Contrast that sharply with securities margin. When you buy stocks on margin, you are explicitly borrowing actual dollars from your broker. You have taken out a very real loan, and therefore you absolutely owe interest on that borrowed amount for every single day you hold the position open.
And the final point of comparison, ownership. In futures, posting a margin deposit means you own absolutely no commodity. You don't own a single physical kernel of wheat. You merely own a contract, which is a standardized legal obligation.
In securities margin, the buyer actually owns the physical shares of the stock, even though the broker holds them in street name as collateral for the margin loan.
So listener, when you are staring at a question about the futures performance bond, run through this checklist in your head. No loan, no interest, no physical ownership. It is strictly a deposit to make sure you can survive the daily mark-to-market meat grinder.
If you keep those strict differences categorized in your head, you will easily dodge several of the most common trick questions on the test.
All right, let's take a breath, let the math settle, and transition to our third big force. So far, we have built this massive symmetric multiplier called leverage. It is sitting there, coiled and ready to explode Ricky's account in either a positive or negative direction. But here's the thing. A multiplier times zero is still zero. If the global price of wheat just sat perfectly still at $10 a bushel for 6 months, the 20-to-1 leverage wouldn't do anything. What actually activates the leverage?
Price volatility. Volatility is the spark that drops into the engine cylinder.
Volatility. You know, I have to step in here and play devil's advocate for a second. In normal, everyday conversation, people usually use the word volatile as the strictly negative term, like a volatile chemical compound that might blow up your laboratory, or a volatile political situation that causes chaos. We are culturally conditioned to think volatility means pure danger.
And that cultural conditioning is exactly the psychological trap the NFA exam writers want to catch you in. In the futures market, volatility is not inherently a bad word. It is entirely mathematically neutral.
I need you to explain that to me because it sounds really counterintuitive. How can massive price swings be neutral?
Because price volatility is simply defined as the degree to which a futures price moves up and down over a given period of time. It is the raw material of the speculative industry. Without price movement, there is absolutely no opportunity for profit. A flat, stagnant price pays absolutely no one.
Let's use an analogy to ground this. Think of speculator Sally as a highly skilled sailor on a high-performance sailboat. In this scenario, volatility is the wind. If the market is dead calm, meaning there is zero volatility, the price of wheat just sits at $10 forever. Sally's boat is stranded in the middle of a glass flat ocean. She makes $0. She desperately needs the wind to pick up to push her boat forward toward her profit target.
That is exactly right. The wind provides the essential opportunity. But critically, that exact same wind can suddenly shift direction and smash her boat violently into the rocks.
Right.
The wind doesn't possess morality. It doesn't care which way Sally's boat is pointing. It just blows.
Volatility is completely indifferent to Ricky's hopes and dreams.
A speculator cannot ask the market to only provide movement in their favorable direction. Volatility is just the movement itself. It creates the necessary condition for a massive gain. And by definition, it creates the exact equal condition for a massive loss.
So if we smash our two forces together, we get the deadly combo, volatility multiplied by leverage.
This specific interaction is exactly where futures contracts earn their reputation as incredibly high-risk instruments for the retail trader. These two forces compound each other aggressively.
But wait, I'm going to push back here on behalf of the listener because we need to reconcile something. You just spent a huge chunk of time telling us how incredibly small the upfront initial margin deposit is. If I only have to put up $5,000, why are futures considered such high-risk instruments? Isn't my risk limited because I'm only committing a small amount of cash?
This circles back to the magnifying glass effect we touched on earlier. Remember, your percentage return and your percentage loss is measured against that tiny deposit, not against the massive full contract value.
Right. Exactly.
So let's say the broader commodity markets are experiencing what we would consider perfectly normal, modest, day-to-day price wobbles. A 1% move up on Monday, a 2% move down on Tuesday. Nothing crazy. The underlying physical commodity is not being wildly volatile in historical terms.
Okay, so just a gentle everyday breeze.
But you put the magnifying glass of leverage over that gentle breeze. A simple 2% drop in the price of a massive notional contract translates into a 40% or 60% or even 100% wipeout of your tiny performance bond in a single afternoon.
Boom. The boat hits the rocks.
Exactly. Modest, completely normal volatility, when magnified by extreme 20-to-1 or 30-to-1 leverage, produces explosive account-draining swings in the trader's equity. That compounded mathematical interaction is what makes futures inherently high risk for speculators.
And this is exactly why the exchanges have mechanisms to deal with extreme volatility, right?
Yeah.
Because if things get too crazy, the clearinghouse itself is at risk.
Yes, and this is worth noting for the exam context. Exchanges implement systems like daily price limits, often called limit up or limit down. If a commodity price moves too violently in a single day, the exchange will literally halt trading beyond that price boundary to give the market time to digest the news and prevent a total systemic panic. It is a circuit breaker to stop the compounding destruction of leverage and volatility.
It's exam trap alert. Listener, listen closely to the phrasing of your questions. If you are reading a question about volatility, and one of the answers treats volatility as only a danger or only an opportunity, it is a trap.
It is neutral. It is inherently two-sided.
If the multiple choice option says volatility is the primary reason speculators face risk, that is only half the truth. Cross it out. If it says volatility guarantees profits for highly skilled analytical traders, that is marketing nonsense. Cross it out. Volatility is the sole reason you can profit, and it is the exact same reason you can get wiped out. It is the wind and the rocks.
I think we have thoroughly deconstructed what the speculator gets out of this arrangement.
We have. Sally gets incredible leverage. She gets the volatility she needs to execute her models, and she gets the opportunity for massive, magnified returns on her capital. But let's pan the camera back. Let's bring this full circle back to Farmer Frank out in his wheat field. What is the broader market, and what does Frank specifically get from having Sally and 10,000 algorithmic traders just like her hanging around the exchange executing millions of trades a day?
This brings us to our fourth and arguably most important systemic force, market liquidity.
Market liquidity. Let's define the term clearly before we unpack it.
Market liquidity is formally defined as the ease with which a trader can enter or exit a position quickly at a price very close to the last traded price without their own order causing the market price to move.
Okay, listener, I want to ask you a direct scenario question. Think about this. Let's say Farmer Frank has successfully hedged his wheat. He sold short futures contracts to lock in his price. But 2 months later, a massive localized hailstorm completely destroys his actual physical crop. He no longer has any physical wheat to sell.
Oh, tragic.
Therefore, he no longer needs the financial hedge. In fact, keeping the short futures position open is now incredibly dangerous for him because it's no longer tied to a physical asset. It has become a pure, naked, speculative short. He needs to exit his short futures position right now, today, this very minute. What happens if speculator Sally and all the other speculators aren't there?
Think about the mechanics of the exchange if it's just farmers trading with other farmers.
Right. Think about it for a beat.
If the market is just Frank and a handful of other commercial hedgers who all share similar risks, and Frank suddenly hits the panic button and screams, "I need to buy back my contracts immediately to exit."
He is completely stuck.
He's trapped in a burning building with no exits.
Exactly. Or because he is desperate, he is going to have to accept a truly terrible, highly disadvantageous price to convince one of the very few other people in the market to take the other side of his urgent trade.
Because there's no crowd. Speculators are the crowd of the market. That is a highly accurate way to visualize it. Imagine an actual physical marketplace, like a massive global bazaar. If you walk into a packed, roaring marketplace with thousands of merchants actively screaming out prices, competing with each other for every transaction, you can buy or sell a rug in 2 seconds at a very fair, highly competitive price. Someone is always ready to take your trade.
That is a textbook highly liquid market.
But if you walk into an empty, cavernous warehouse with only two tired guys standing in the corner, that is an illiquid, thin market. You walk up and say, "I urgently need to sell this rug." One guy looks at you and says, "I'll give you $5 for it. Take it or leave it. I'm the only buyer in the room."
You get totally gouged. Speculators pack the warehouse. By standing ready to take the other side of hedgers' trades, and importantly, by trading constantly at high frequencies with each other, they provide the massive volume necessary for the market to function smoothly. They ensure that Farmer Frank can hit a button on his computer and instantly, within milliseconds, find a counterparty to exit his trade.
And this massive crowd effect does something incredibly important mathematically for everyone involved. It narrows the bid-ask spread.
Okay, let's unpack the bid-ask spread. This is a crucial concept for understanding market efficiency.
The bid-ask spread is simply the numerical gap between the highest price a buyer is currently willing to pay the bid and the lowest price a seller is currently willing to accept the ask.
I always like to explain the bid-ask spread as the toll you have to pay just for the privilege of trading.
That is exactly what it is, a transaction cost.
Let's run a simulation. Reckless Ricky wants to buy a single wheat contract. The bestseller in a very thin, empty, illiquid market is asking for $10. But Ricky only wants to bid $9. There is a massive $1 gap between them. If Ricky gets impatient and really wants into the trade right now, he has to cross the gap and pay the seller's asking price of $10. He just paid a massive $1 toll.
But what happens when you introduce 10,000 algorithmic speculator sallies into that exact same market?
They start aggressively competing for the trade. Sally number one analyzes her data and says, I'll sell it for $9.90. Sally number two says, I'll undercut her. I'll sell it for $9.80. Sally number three says, I'll pay $9.10. I'll pay $9.20.
Suddenly, the order book tightens up. The best bid from the crowd is $9.49, and the best ask is $9.50. The spread, the gap between them, has shrunk from a full painful dollar down to just a single penny.
The crowd dramatically lowered the toll for everyone, including Farmer Frank. Because of all these speculators fighting for fractions of a penny in profit, when Frank desperately needs to exit his hedge, he gets an incredibly efficient, fair price without getting completely gouged by a wide spread.
This is exactly why robust liquidity is so utterly vital for offsetting positions. Remember earlier, we established that most futures positions are closed by offset, making an equal and opposite trade to cancel the original one, rather than holding it to expiration.
Right. If you buy a contract to open, you must sell a contract to close before it expires. You don't want a literal train car full of live cattle showing up on your front lawn because you forgot to offset your position.
Exactly. The entire system relies on offset. And you desperately need a deep, liquid market to ensure you can execute that offsetting trade exactly when you want to at a fair, predictable price. A thin, illiquid market makes offset incredibly dangerous, highly volatile, and financially costly. Abundant speculation is the necessary lubricant that keeps the entire global hedging machine spinning smoothly.
Exam trap alert. Final siren for this deep dive, listener. Pay very close attention. The NFA exam writers have a favorite recurring lie they like to tell about liquidity to see if you actually understand the market structure.
It shows up on almost every single version of the test in some format.
They will offer an answer choice that confidently claims that speculators destabilize the market, or that speculators drain liquidity, or that their presence makes commercial hedging harder and more expensive.
It is a total, absolute lie designed to test your core comprehension.
Cross it out with extreme prejudice. Speculators supply the liquidity. Write this down, internalize it, memorize it. The two fundamental things speculators provide to the marketplace are capital, which is used to bear the transferred risk, and volume, which provides the essential liquidity.
Assuming risk and providing liquidity. If an exam answer credits speculators with only one of those two functions while ignoring the other, it is likely an incomplete or trick answer. They are fundamentally required to do both for the market to function.
All right, we have covered a truly massive amount of ground today. We have taken the burning hot potato of price risk from Farmer Frank, handed it directly to speculator Sally, multiplied its impact with a massive financial lever, blown it around with the unpredictable wind of volatility, and dropped it into a screaming, hyper-competitive crowd of liquid traders. Let's bring it all together for the final exam push.
It's time for the rapid-fire recap. Let's lock in the absolute must-remember, highly testable takeaways from this unit.
I'll take the first one. Let's talk risk asymmetry. A long position, which means buying a contract, has large but bounded risk because the price fundamentally stops at zero.
A short position, which means selling a contract to open, has theoretically unlimited risk because there is absolutely no mathematical ceiling on how high panic-driven prices can climb.
Leverage and volatility are perfectly symmetric forces. They magnify your wins and your losses equally. And critically, because of the daily mark-to-market process, losses can and frequently will exceed your initial margin deposit.
The performance bond is a good faith security deposit, not a down payment on a loan. There is no borrowing of funds, and you owe zero interest to the broker.
And finally, speculators have absolutely zero commercial interest in the underlying physical commodity. They are participating purely to bring liquidity through volume and to take on the hedger's price risk with their capital.
Those are your foundational pillars. If you build your understanding firmly on those facts, you can dismantle and solve almost any complex scenario the exam throws at you.
Before we sign off, we always like to leave the listener with something to chew on. Something that stretches these concepts just a little bit further into the real world. What have you got for us today?
We've spent this entire deep dive talking about the elegant, symbiotic relationship between Farmer Frank and Speculator Sally. How speculators exist functionally to take on physical risk from commercial hedgers. But I want you to think about this. What happens when a financial market becomes so incredibly liquid and so heavily crowded with algorithmic speculators that the speculators are mostly just trading rapidly back and forth with other speculators?
Oh, I see where you're going with this.
If Farmer Frank's actual physical wheat hedging represents only a tiny fractional percentage of the massive daily market volume, does the hot potato of physical risk actually get neutralized? Or are we just watching a giant, high-speed, algorithmic game of hot potato played entirely by people in glass high-rises who don't even own farms, passing synthetic risk back and forth millions of times a second? Think about the broader implications of a financial market that grows so incredibly large and complex that it exists almost entirely to sustain its own trading volume.
That is slightly terrifying, honestly. The physical reality of the wheat and the tractors vanishes entirely, replaced by pure math. We are right back to staring at a murky financial illusion.
Chew on that while you study your flashcards.
Keep at it, listener. Avoid Ricky's traps, respect the ruthless power of leverage, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.